So just to reiterate, I think what Pete was asking is, how will we know when it's appropriate time to reboot everybody's businesses?
Well, we'll see the curve flattening. So we actually have ways of tracking that. And as we see the curve flattening, then we've slowed the transmission down to within our capabilities, then we can't, I wouldn't call it backing off, I would call it re-engineering, because we can't get an effect and then stop and then immediately lose that effect. But we can keep it up in different ways, because it really is about learned human behavior. That's what this kind of virus transmission occurs. So as people learn new behaviors, hand washing is so elemental that people don't even believe what a role that plays. But it's huge. If you just treat your hands as if they're contaminated unless you decontaminate them, that you're about 90% of the way to preventing infection.
Can I ask a question, Michelle? This is Kate. Dr. Luck, is it safe to assume that guidance and further restrictions, orders, changes of action will be at the state level, and we will be in lockstep with the state and the governor versus having our own localized recommendations or interventions?
Absolutely. We have the authority to adopt more stringent kind of local strategies in the state, but there's almost no situations when we would do that, because it creates these perverse incentives where, I think what the merchants saw last weekend or the weekend before, if restaurants are open in one place and closed in another, people naturally move to the place where they're open. So we really have to do it as a statewide. But we have the authority at a local level. The two individuals who have sort of unlimited authority in this situation are the governor and the local health officer. And there's more than one local health officer, of course.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Locke. I guess I'll take the benefit of my position to say, once again, it sounds like I'm pressing you, but I heard from you that 5 to 6 weeks was what we sort of need to see the effects, that it takes 3 weeks of not having these businesses operating, and then 5 to 6 to see if we've actually have been successful. Is that correct?
Yes, and I have to be realistic. It's harder to measure that in Jefferson County because we're not seeing that curve shoot up yet. We don't have near the testing capability we'd like to have. We places like South Korea are doing hundreds of thousands of tests, and it's going to grow into the millions. And actually, that's feasible. We will eventually get to that point sooner than you think. We may have local testing available middle to late part of April. There are a lot of moving parts in this, but we have very good data about what's going on in King County. We don't have it as well in this county. That's probably the thing we are most concerned about. If we see a surge of county residents needing hospitalization because they have COVID-19, that means we're not flattening the curve enough.
Okay. So with that, because Dr. Locke does have to leave early, I'm going to open the questioning to elected officials. How about Kate, if you have people who are in council, if you can coordinate those questions first, and then we'll go to the ones who are online.
Sure, thank you for handing it over to us. We've just had the benefit of a couple of hours with Dr. Locke at Board of Health, so in the interest of time, I think I will defer, but...
I have one from a business perspective that I didn't ask earlier. I know that regarding testing, Healthcare workers are a priority, of course, and I'm just wondering about grocery workers. We have a couple grocery stores in the family, and is there, that seems like, you know, a critical service that we want to keep open, and I'm wondering, you know, is there any different practice we should be taking to our employees in the grocery industry? I mean, we've sent at risk, you know, people with immune compromised systems and people over 60, we've sent them home already on sick leave, but is there anything else that grocery stores should do to be prepared or to be, you know, with testing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly practicing these optimal infection control practices is really important because they're habits. You know, the more you do them, the better you get at doing them consistently. And then, you know, in terms of grocery workers, you know, really all people who serve the public in business, we will. It's very important that we have a system that can notify them if they've been exposed. In other words, once we identify a case, we do these very detailed, they're actually very sophisticated. This is our core competency in figuring out who people with infectious diseases have come in contact with in a way that they put that person at risk of getting the disease. So we're using that. And conceivably, grocery workers and business employees will be on that list. They will be told you have had a significant exposure, and we want you to go into quarantine. And our goal is to notify them at a point in time that's well before they're contagious. So people that go into quarantine are not contagious before they go into quarantine. And most of them who go into quarantine do not get infection. You know, we have disrupted their life for 2 weeks for a purely precautionary way. But if they do get symptoms, we test them. And if they are infected, then hopefully they have no further contacts because they've been in quarantine. That's how it works.
Quarantine a grocery store though, one of our larger grocery stores has a case of COVID-19.
In most cases, there would not be the close contact exposure we'd be worried about. It could be among the workers, though. For instance, back in the break room, that could meet the criteria. So you could end up, it could be a real workforce issue where you don't have enough, these employees are in 14-day quarantine. Most of them will be back in 14 days. And we may develop the technology to, at a certain point in the illness, say, you know, 7 to 12 days after exposure, we may have a rule-out test, but that might be unlikely. You know, something we're really getting out there to people is a negative COVID test only says that you have undetectable virus right at that moment. And it doesn't rule out infection. It doesn't say that 3 days from now your levels will rise and you will have the infection. And it doesn't say that you won't be exposed tomorrow and start the whole process going from scratch. So we have to kind of disabuse people that we can that testing will serve that function. It's really testing is to detect illness and identify cases and then identify contacts so that we can break the cycle of transmission.
Great.
Yes. Over to council?
Or with David Sullivan, maybe?
Oh, sure.
Then head up to city council. David Sullivan, do you have any questions for Dr. Locke or comments?
No. I think, like you say, we got a full briefing at the Board of Health and have been keeping up on this day-to-day, so
that was good time. Monica McHager, no, the questions people are asking tonight are very good. I have none myself.
This is Amy Howard. I have a quick question.
Similar to how we do inspections with restaurants, is it possible that there's someone who can go into grocery stores and teach best practices so we can and make sure everybody is up to date on how to interact with the public?
They go through the same training at grocery stores.
But do they have that same level of inspection at the checkout counter as opposed to the deli?
Yeah.
I wrote that down. That's an excellent idea. I would mention, as Commissioner Brotherton says, you know, food service workers go through very specific kind of food safety training that gives them kind of a head start in terms of preventing transfer of disease, all these things that prevent salmonella and the toxic form of E. coli and all of these things that we see in foods, especially raw meats. Those things are very helpful in preventing virus transmission. But the idea I wrote down, you know, certainly kind of enhanced food worker safety, and then, you know, doing just as we send kind of inspectors into restaurants, which are actually more educators than inspectors. They're there to teach people optimal food handlers. That just the notion of having people who are like infection control, community mitigation specialists. We're not gonna be able to provide that from the health department, but this is where community mobilization comes in. We have a lot of talented people in this community, and that's an idea, that's a feasible idea, is to not just ask people to stay aware of the different guidance documents and the information on the web, but give them that hands-on training. Although all hands-on training will be with washed hands, I would say that.
And I would say that applies equally to retail and workplace and the many sectors that would benefit, that are, you know, not under order currently, that would benefit from trained professionals or even volunteers to help with workplace safety.
Thank you.
Is there any other elected official in the chambers that has a question?
Nope.
Okay, how about the elected officials on the phone? David Faber?
Hi, thank you, Michelle. And thank you so much, Dr. Locke, for the very informative briefing tonight. This is fantastic. Another question, I've been seeing this Imperial College report from the UK going around, setting basically a timeline that estimates 18 months of mitigation measures that would need to be implemented. And I know you've spoken about finding a new normal after maybe 6 weeks where we try and, you know, all behave more like a medical or healthcare worker. Wondering if that is sort of, if those two pieces line up together, or if you're saying something that is different from this Imperial College report, or if you have any thoughts on that report. And then also knock on with that, if you have any information about the sort of vaccine timeline. I've also heard 18 months for the creation and then sufficient testing for a vaccine. And this is probably outside the you know, immediate scope of your work, but I'm wondering, because you're the local expert here, if you have any thoughts on those.
Yeah, and this is actually in my medical specialty. I mean, I could call myself a medical epidemiologist if I wanted to, and I'm very interested in those modeling studies. This is modern epidemiology, is to do very sophisticated computer modeling, and the British studies are sort of the outer range, and paradoxically they're based on sort of optimal community mitigation. So the more we flatten the curve and modulate the surge, the longer we continue this. The shortest duration would be if we did nothing at all, and this would just burn through the population, and we'd have catastrophic preventable mortality, but it would be over really quick. And so the range we're seeing in these modeling projections are in the 5 to 18 months range. So what you cite is kind of the outside. It is true, vaccine optimistically is 12 months, more likely 18 months, because vaccines not only can be hard to produce and test and make sure they work and that they're safe, but then ramping up production. Actually, what we're putting more hope in is antiviral medications, because the world was developing several promising anti-SARS drugs back in 2003, but unfortunately, the way the pharmaceutical industry works is when SARS went away, so did the incentive to continue developing these. But they didn't throw away the research. Immediately China started using a drug called remicidir. They've been testing that on people in the hospital. We're doing those tests in Seattle and around the country, and there's other promising drugs. So drugs can be mass produced much more rapidly than vaccines. So if we had an antiviral drug,
Oh, just wanted to clarify too. You mentioned SARS, and that was another coronavirus, correct?
Yeah, a very close cousin. Even more serious in terms of fatality rates, but also it didn't have everyone with SARS was sick, so they were easier to identify. But Jeff, these anti-SARS drugs are kind of a head start on developing an anti-COVID-19 drug, and that, you know, that's a tool that we could have in our hands much sooner, and we'd use it first for the critically ill, but potentially we could use it to prevent infections or treat them at an earlier stage, so the period of contagion is shortened. So those kind of things could substantially change the trajectory of this.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, Ariel, do you have any questions for Dr. Locke?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Dr. Locke. I had a question about the testing and whether there's a percentage of false negatives and what that percentage is and if that's a concern.
Very much so. And that if you test too early, you know, and especially if you test what we call an asymptomatic contact. So someone who's had a real exposure, but we test too early, we can get a false negative. They are infected, they will eventually get sick, or at least shed the virus, but we tested too early in the course of the illness. We don't think there's a significant false positive problem. That's a potential problem with this kind of test, because these tests are amplifying very tiny amounts of genetic material. So as they scramble to do mass production, they have to be really careful and very accurate to prevent these false positives. But a false positive has less of a consequence. You know, we end up isolating you for a period of time, but there's no harm done.
Thank you, Dr. Locke. Owen, Councillor Rowe, do you have any questions?
Yes, I'd just like to second the comments, questions from Commissioner Brotherton and Councilmember Howard, and thank Dr. Locke for the response about that, about grocery stores in particular. And that's a concern that has definitely come up, and I've heard from the community. And really what it comes down to is that grocery stores and other essential services are having to develop this additional skill and potentially add staff to manage this environment rather than simply managing food service. And so I guess I would like to thank Dr. Locke for his response to that and encourage development of that, those ideas, and let us know how we can help.
Thank you, Owen. So is Pam Adams on the line? No, I don't think she is. Okay, so there's, I believe we have a couple of more elected officials, though they're not city or county. Pete, would you like to ask any questions?
Yeah, just kind of a follow-on, Dr. Locke, to the earlier comments about Jefferson County being ahead of the curve, particularly related to King County. And, you know, as far as the health officer being able to create more stringent conditions in a particular area than others, is it possible for them to relax situations because we are more isolated and we are more ahead of the curve? Is that a possibility?
That's an interesting legal question. You know, whether essentially a governor's order, and I think probably a governor's order would trump a local health officer, but I don't know. That's a legal question. In practice, it's very unlikely that we would do that. We would be more likely to do something more stringent. You know, if we had some kind of particular activity that was occurring that was hazardous, although in those cases it would very likely be an individual kind of practice. If someone was doing something that we thought was extraordinarily harmful, we would try to stop them. And we could, although virtually all isolation and quarantine is voluntary, it's voluntary compliance, we have the authority to mandate it, and there's a criminal penalty for violating a health officer order. There can be criminal penalties assessed for other kinds of behaviors, but yeah, I don't think relaxing things. What would happen in that case is, you know, if the data told us that we could start relaxing things in rural areas, the governor would modify his order. And he'd say something like, at the discretion of the local health officer, you can back off on these certain things. We've got a really responsive governor in this state. I mean, he's doing what we asked him to do. And if we can do things that are consistent with the goals of slowing transmission, then I don't think he would oppose that. So I think that's how that scenario would play out, is he would modify his order and then we would have more flexibility locally.
So
thank you, Dr. Locke.
Thank you. Commissioner Putney, do you have anything? You're wearing two hats tonight, but do you have any questions or concerns?
Not at the moment. My concerns are really more about the businesses that the port supports. I had a really great briefing from the doctor on Monday at the county commission meeting. So I'm sated on that front, but I have real concerns about business, of course, as everyone does.
Thank you. We're gonna get to our community resources for our businesses, employees, right after we finish up here. Lastly, respectfully, I'd like to go to Aaron from the port next, and then either John Morrow or Philip Morley, if any of you have questions.
Yeah, I don't have any questions for the doctor, and we'll be happy to give the port report when the time is right.
Thank you, Aaron. Philip Morley, do you have any questions?
No.
Thank you. City Manager John Morrow, do you have any questions?
No, we've got a lot of people to get through, so let's just keep moving. Thank you very much.
Mayor Sandoval, I think Shelley from Jefferson County Historical Society has a question.
Can I ask a quick question? So as we know that school and jobs provide a lot of stability for people in a community, particularly.
Can you come to the mic?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Join the front mic.
So I'll just say this again. School and jobs create stability for our community, and particularly vulnerable populations. So my question is, what are the effects of job loss on public health, both mental and physical well-being, and how is the health department talking about and hopefully planning for the additional burdens of what is sort of a ancillary public health crisis that may be created by a long-term job loss in our community?
Yeah, we definitely know in public health that economic factors, socioeconomic status is, as it's called, is probably the greatest determinant of health, a social determinant of health. And actually, Jefferson County Public Health, we have an extraordinary range of programs that deals with the most vulnerable populations through our WIC program and our visiting nurse program and our family planning program. So, we're not only sensitive to the problems as categories, we know the populations. We have personal relationship with them. So I would in no way diminish the impact. It's society's responsibility to step in and to support these families and individuals economically immediately. This is the role of government. And most of it comes federal, because federal has the ability to borrow money and also to change tax codes, to mobilize billions and trillions of dollars to kind of preserve the social fabric during this crisis. And if they don't do that, they failed in their primary mission. Mission of government is health, safety, and welfare. And this is welfare. And I don't mean it in the pejorative way. I mean it in terms of the welfare of communities.
The great segue.
Thank you. Dr. Locke, I believe that we've round robin for everybody, and I do have one question for you, and that is, we have the directive or mandate from the governor in regards to bars and walk-in restaurants, and a lot of our businesses are being creative about takeout and curbside service. My question is one that I've gotten from other merchants, and they don't have anything to do with the food or alcohol industry, and that is their storefronts, and should they remain open? That's the question that I get. Or is it something that this community, even though it is not a mandate from the state, they're not considered necessarily an essential service. Some of them have taken it upon themselves to close. I drove around town today, and banks are closed, and certain businesses are closed, but there are other merchants that are open. Is it something that we should encourage as the Port Townsend Jefferson County community to encourage everyone to close down for a 2 or 3 week period during this, to flatten the curve?
I think so. I think that's we have an enormous benefit if we do that well. If we do it well, it's called flushing the system, that everyone that's currently infected will either get better or need hospital care within a 3 week period. And so it's a kind of a reset. If we could do it perfectly and as close as we can get to that, the better. There are businesses, there may not be an increased transmission risk. It's really a case-by-case basis, and we don't have the personnel to evaluate those. But I encourage it, and I also encourage it, to not look at it as close so much as take this period to reinvent what you do for this outbreak period that we're entering into, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. For instance, campaigns to maximize takeout food. We put in a big order from the health department today I think we'll do that every day. You know, instead of bringing our lunches to work, we will order takeout to support local merchants. And you know, we need to do things like that. People who, you know, can go online and sell things that way. We can figure out ways to get their products to people. And the highest priority thing is we do not want people in high-risk groups to be out there mingling with people who are in low-risk groups, and especially, you know, young people who, you know, like all young people, believe themselves to be indestructible and are probably going to have higher rates of infection. You know, this is a case where we don't want to mix the generations, at least in this period of intensive community mitigation.
Okay, thank you. So we will encourage all the merchants that remain open, including real estate offices, for instance, of which I am an owner. We're virtually working online, but even closing the storefronts for those for a certain period of time. So thank you for that advice, because some people do need to hear that directly from you.
Michelle, can I ask a question relating to the food service part of that response?
Of course, Allison. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to reiterate, I'm feeling like Keith, where I really need to know if I'm benefiting the community by staying open or if I'm pushing the envelope, because I will shut down tomorrow. If this isn't the best thing, it's a hard decision if what we're doing is actually beneficial for the community, because I want to feed everybody. That's what I'm here to do. But if it's even that the restaurants should take a 2-week break, we will do that.
I recommend against that. I think if what you're saying is, if staying open means continuing a takeout service or distribution of healthy food, by all means do that. Try to find a way to expand that.
Okay, that's what we're working on. So I just wanted to hear that from you. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you, Dr. Locke. I think that that's going to be the questions for this evening. Unless I hear from anyone else, we're going to move on to what the resources are for our employers and for our employees with all of our different resources here in the community. So I thank you very much, Dr. Locke, for attending. And I guess I'll call on first the EDC director, Brian. Are you on the line?
Hey, good evening, Michelle. Thank you.
If you could give us a report, I know that you've been tracking all of the various resources that the state and federal government have employed, and I'm just hoping that you could give us a report and how people can plug in the local business owners in order to access those resources.
You bet, and thank you for pulling this meeting together, Madam Mayor, and City Council members, and our commissioners, and Christy, honorable mention there too, for catalyzing this. We have been doing our best to stay on top of the many programs that are rolling out by the hour for specifically businesses, and doing a lot of work to coordinate with our peer agencies in the region and the state. So I'll go over some of the ones that you've heard of or maybe haven't heard of, and then close with letting you know where to go to get more information. Some of the ones that folks I think have heard in this past week is that all counties, including Jefferson, are eligible for SBA disaster loans for economic injury. And so those are live and taking applications right now. And those are supposed to be low interest loans, up to $2 million for, you know, borrowers to get through this period. It was recently announced, I believe yesterday, the governor is authorizing micro grants for businesses, recognizing that loans aren't the best tool for every business. And so the Department of Commerce is working on how to deploy those. And I suspect they'll be calling on us to be local feet on the ground for that program. Other things that we're seeing is, and this was part of the governor's announcement as well, is an expansion of unemployment benefits, not only looking to streamline it for employees that were recently laid off or downsized, but also to include independent contractors and small business owners. in that as well, including modifying the rules of traditional unemployment. So somebody who was laid off, arguably temporarily, doesn't need to apply for four different jobs per week as is customary. So working on modifying that to be most relevant and responsive. Other things coming up include the SBDC, Small Business Development Counselors, Business Resiliency Seminars and Toolkit, which are available out there, and upcoming seminars for businesses to access at no cost. The Department of Revenue is providing B&O tax relief, and so looking to get a hand on that and what that means to businesses. And then I think most folks have heard about the IRS allowing for a 90-day tax deferral. Still need to file your taxes on time, but you have 90 extra days to make that payment to them. So what to expect next? The EDC, and along with our partners, the Chamber, the North Olympic Development Council, and others, we're going to be pushing out a survey for business owners, nothing too onerous, but trying to get our hands on what the impact has been here. We know it's significant, but putting some numbers behind that, and that's information that the governor's office and Department of Commerce have requested and will find very helpful. Other things we're doing, and again, Arlene will speak a lot to what's kind of coming through the door at the Business Resource Center, but really shifting to provide direct outreach and support to local businesses. We know business owners are under a tremendous amount of stress right now, and our job is to do the best we can with reaching out to them proactively to provide this information. And then Commissioner Dean and Mayor Sandoval have also called on our organization to assist with the creation of a task force to address what's next after after we put out the fire, so to speak. And that's something that Christy had queued up earlier in her comments about the new vision. So that's something we look forward to assisting with. I'm going to stop there, but just encourage folks to find out more or contact us. Please do. EDCteamJefferson.org. We're available, you know, even if we're sheltering in place or social distancing, we're going to reach out and interact with you virtually and help where we can. So I know Deb Stinson has some exciting news to share, and Arlene has some things that she wants to share as well.
Thank you, Brian, and thanks to you for being succinct, because we still have a lot to get through on the agenda. So next, I'm hoping that Mari Mullen from Main Street could give an update as to what Main Street's been up to in reaching out to our community merchants.
Yes, thank you, Mayor Sandoval, and thank you everyone for inviting us to be part of this important discussion. And we have really been focusing our efforts to collate the resources that we've been getting daily. As Brian had mentioned, there's just so much information coming through, so we've created three COVID-19 resource buttons on our ptmainstreet.org website. And there are so many great resources out there, and Arlene has been working so hard to develop information too, so we're trying not to duplicate one another's information, but between the Chamber and Main Street, there are lots of resource links out there. And also Governor Jay Inslee's website is just so thorough with the updates, and it's broken up by how businesses
can be helped. Mari, yes. I'm going to interrupt for one moment. Is it possible for you to take yourself off the speaker, because it's very difficult to hear you?
Oh, I don't know how to do that.
She's in the room with us.
I'm speaking at the microphone here.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I thought you were on the speakerphone. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. I could speak more slowly.
You're kind of speaking there and to that.
Oh, maybe just
come
over
speak. Yeah, would it be
helpful
to speak into the, I think, no.
I could just yell from the room.
I think it's the microphone.
Can we tell from our KPTZ?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay. It's sounds like audio quality is better.
You got a little reverb.
Is this okay? Is this better? But basically, I'll just talk a little bit about the resources that we have been getting. I just, again, wanted to repeat that the Governor Inslee website has got a great breakdown of everything you could need, and I hope the health department will look at that so they don't reinvent the wheel. And there's
you know, we did help apply for the SBA designation, which Brian mentioned now is for all counties in Washington, but those 3.75 low interest loans through SBA could be a great tool. But the number one thing that I have heard back from merchants is what they need now is monetary help, and they want to make sure that Port Townsend gets in the process to receive funds as soon as possible, because if you don't have any income, you cannot pay your monthly bill. So the stimulus funds, all those packages that are underway, is just so heartening. And the loan programs are a great tool, but a cash infusion is what people need. And then we do have a low interest loan program through Main Street. We have the, what we call the Lent Micro Loan Fund, and it's up to $4,000 per application, and the deadline for that is April 15th, but that could help with rent relief for businesses. And if there were others that wanted to add into that program, you know, if the city had funds they wanted to contribute to that, we could help more people. And the Jefferson Community Foundation has added that on their website, so if any of their donors want to put into the microloan loan fund, that would be a welcome thing. And then just, you know, the other thing that we've just been thinking about is, besides promoting the resources, you know, and promoting restaurants to for the takeout programs and listing, you know, we're doing a lot of social media around that, but also just getting our message right. You know, we're not doing things about come downtown and shop the sales right now, and we're not really encouraging tourism, but it does make us think about what can businesses do to help themselves. And what they can do to help themselves is to have a current website with a button on there that people could buy gift certificates. Click here to buy a gift certificate. Click here to put your takeout order. And I know Chris Nelson got all her restaurants, you know, with able to have takeout, you know, the buttons there, and to buy gift certificates. So it's just really important. And then to connect that to your social media, and that seems obvious, but it isn't 100% there. And that's thing everyone could do. And the other thing I just think about is that, and I don't know if there's a way to do it, but in Seattle they have a grocery voucher program, and the city is giving $600 in grocery vouchers to those in need. Is there any way we could do something like that would help our restaurants? And then, you know, to focus on the welcome back plans, you know, to create a marketing plan for Port Townsend to bring business and customers and tourism back once this is over, and work with our partners to develop that plan. And Facebook is going to put out a $1 million in ads for 30,000 businesses. I want to get on that Facebook train for that. And just working with the media, we have been doing a lot of outreach, and it's a two-way conversation, and they have been so helpful about getting the word out. So that's what I've got. And go to ptmainstreet.org and shop locally where you can. And if the health department's recommendation, we were following the governor's guidelines on that, and he had not said to close retail. So that was new information as of tonight. We have had a couple of merchants ask, and many of them have closed on their own, or are temporarily closed, or offering more limited hours. But we just encourage people to order takeout and keep in the conversation on social media. Thank you.
Thank you, Mari. Arlene, Ellen from the Chamber, would you like to give your update? I know you've been working with Brian a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor, and council members and commissioners for all the support you've been giving to all the organizations and to the community, and for pulling together this meeting. I know people are often confused about what chambers do, and chambers have morphed and changed along with every other organization. And several years back, the chamber board here made the determination to really embrace a new model for this chamber of the future, one that really builds community to build business. And that's the path on which this chamber remains and what we're working to achieve. And chambers traditionally and today provide the means for government and community to really engage in exchanges of ideas and information. And our chamber mirrors that model. And for the past 3 weeks, I think we've been hearing sort of a lot of concerns. We've been doing triage literally every day, the feet on the front lines of an onslaught of calls and emails with real concerns and fears predicated on the feeling that they need to make business and life decisions without really having trustworthy data points. And there seems to also be a serious issue developing with maybe some behavioral health challenges relative to the stress of handling C19 challenges. And resource locators for this issue really need to become made more prevalently available. In our initial response to hearing all of these issues, we initiated rather rapidly a fairly robust program of the aggregating resource links and request responses and made outbound calls to determine and fill the needs with an eye on collaboration going forward. And through that empirical surveying, we developed immediately a chart of audiovisual web platforms so that we could help our community members avoid that redundant research that everybody seemed to start down. You know, do I do Zoom? Do I do this? And so we sort of put that out there early on. Our website, because of the traffic of all of this, social media, with just the restaurant link that we aggregated of a simple database with who's doing takeout, who's doing delivery, who's got curb service, had over 2,000 views in the first 24 hours and 70 shares. There have been over 14,000 views of our website in the last few days. So the information appetite is huge from trustworthy resources, and we are happy to know that they trust us. But we also know that the governor's site and other sites are the places we're sending people to. We are not keeping them to ourselves. I want to thank Willie for his support of what I'm going to say next. He and I got together several months back about a program that we both wanted to do called COAD, Community Organizations Active in Disasters. And the rollout of this program was calendared for the 26th of March. Clearly, we're expecting more than 10 people, so we canceled that event, but we're not canceling the program. It's more important than ever. And once the first initial wave of the public health challenges that we're all facing have passed, we're going to put this program together and roll it out. And it's really designed to provide sustainable community conversation toward planning for diversified sustainability, to help businesses prepare infrastructurally and financially for the challenges that are pre-disaster, which we wish we'd done now, and to provide for communication and rebuilding post a community emergency event. What we're dealing with today would have been greatly less than if we'd had this co-ed program in place. And we now have an amazing opportunity. As you know, Chamber sprinkle pixie dust on everything. So with every disaster, there is opportunity. And this opportunity is to start working through these real challenges. We don't have to create scenarios to work through. They're real ones. And produce some really positive results for our community and migrate to, I think that this particular program could migrate well in part into a future task force involvement. So we're very excited about that. We're also currently aggregating additional data and lists for posting, and we'll continue to do that along the lines of need that we hear from the community in collaboration with our many community partners. In addition, I think to meet the informational challenges and sharing of ideas, we are proposing that we migrate our chamber cafes to a virtual platform for a hosted weekly call-in with our collaborative partner, the EDC, and other community partners, along with professionals in HR, legal, mental health, SBA, to provide updated live information and answer questions. And this particular type of community conversation would be sustained over time and assist our partners in continuing to determine the shifts in community need and the programs that need to embrace or change. And it allows us to showcase the partner agencies and have a flexible very collaborative format for community engagement. Additionally, we have web conferencing for various audience segments that we deal with, accommodations, food service, maritime, real estate, education, and others. So we can share information targeted to multiple audiences with our partner agencies, and also produce web workshops for granting and human resources and healthcare and other topics that we glean from community conversations.
I'm gonna start to wrap you up here because we're getting long on our agenda. So I still need to hear from a few other people, Arlene.
No problem. I'll cut to the tourism chase.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yep. So on the tourism front, the industry is obviously adjusting to a very new reality, and the global expectation is the short term is going to be devastating. We've already lost 4.5 million jobs in the tourism industry in this country, with more to come. That being said, we're a destination that, as we called it, within the 50 miles, and that's of a major metro with a broad-based demographic. So the feeling generally is that we should see a resurgence of visitors later this year, mostly people looking for a short escape from that C-19 reality. But with even if the international restrictions on travel are lifted, most people are going to be reluctant to go down the path. So we would stand in good stead, even though we're pulling back now, continuing the present trajectory to entice people to come visit us in the long term. Right now, best practices in the tourism industry, all businesses are shuttering temporarily throughout the Western region and the country in an attempt universally to flatten the curve and to cut those long-term losses. So we are here to connect the dots, the chamber to business, business to consumer, and in cooperation with our partners to provide these services for a sustainable, successful recovery.
Thank you, Arlene. We'll go ahead and go on to Deborah Stinson, who is representing Lion. Deb, would you like to give an update on what's going on with the Lion Lung?
Yes, thank you, Michelle, and I'll make this quick. So Lion, for those who don't know about it, is the Local Investing Opportunities Network. It's been around since 2006, and we actually were really quite active in the early response to the Great Recession and helped. We've been able to help over 75 businesses grow and thrive since then. So it's a membership network that really provides some of the friendliest money out there. Lion loans are structured, negotiated between the lender and the business directly, and they are structured to meet the needs of the business, and they are very flexible. And part of the reason for that is the members are there because they really want to see these businesses succeed. So even though they design them as well as they can up front, they also are very flexible to adapt as situations change. So as not to put an over heavy burden on the business to have to repay a loan when it's not practical to do so. So we have the process that is set up to help businesses start up and expand, and it's also for nonprofits, and I'll continue to say businesses because it's shorter. So specific to COVID-19, we realized we need to move a little more quickly than we normally do, so we put together a brand new program that's a very streamlined process. And before we did that, we actually had any Lion members that were holding loans to reach out to the businesses they work with to find out if that flexibility needed to be built in now. You know, what do we need to do now to help you succeed? Do we need to stop payments? Do we, you know, what's going to work for you? But this new process is on a fast-track application. You can just go up to the website l2020.org/Lion. And it's right there at the very top. You'll see what it's about. And the idea is we did do a quick survey of our members because, as everybody knows, there's been a pretty big meltdown in the financial markets and pockets aren't quite as deep as they used to be. But we did do a quick survey of our current members, and we believe that we do have sufficient capacity to help at least some portion of our business community either sustain their business through this time or even to provide a bridge until the time that the SBA and other measures coming from the government are available to them. So I really encourage, this could be quick money for the people that really need it now. We want you to go up to the website, check it out, fill out. It's a pretty simple application. When you fill it out, it goes to our partner who does all our administration, which happens to be the EDC. Thank you, Brian. And they'll get it out to the network and start the process. It's all explained up on the website. And the other thing I would like to say, anybody who's hearing this and wants to be able to participate in this program, we always welcome new members. You can also find out how to become a member of Lion. Again, that's l2020.org/Lion, L-I-O-N. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.